In the following recording by the LA Sound Posse, you will hear artist, scholar, and activist Michael Woodson, who has co-produced a show called Living Art on KPFT in Houston, Texas, for many years. On February 10th of 2006, he interviewed Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz is a feminist, a revolutionary, and historian. She speaks about the art of memoir, the social contradictions inherent in contemporary art-making, and introduces her latest book, Blood on the Border, a memoir of the Contra War. In this book, she recounts on-the-ground memories of the Contra War in Nicaragua, chronicling the U.S.-sponsored terror inflicted on the people of Nicaragua following their 1981 election of the socialist Sandinistas that ousted Reagan darling and vicious dictator Somoza.
We are talking today with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz on Living Art. My name is Michael Woodson, and Roxanne has written a book, the third in a series of memoirs. This one's called Blood on the Border, the other two, Outlaw Woman and Red Dirt. And talk a little bit about turning history into art then.
I settled on writing memoir. I know, you know, historians in general have always claimed that history is not a science, not meant to be. It's a narrative, and it's an art. But most historians don't work at their writing, and there are many complaints, including from me, of the density and turgidness of much historical writing, which really turns people off. I mean, there are some notably creative writers, you know, with history, but not very many, and it's not the kind of, it's not really what I would call art. It is narrative history, telling stories. But there's then the problem, I think, of not really grounding that kind of history into any kind of overview of how things came to be as they are, a context. And the context I've always used in my previous work, which were pretty straightforward scholarly history books, The Great Sioux Nation, Roots of Resistance, The History of Land Tenure in New Mexico, Indians of the Americas, Self-Determination, and Human Rights and Economic Development in American Indian Reservations. In those books, I used, you know, just very straightforward historical techniques. After I spent the better part of the 1980s in Nicaragua, upon which this present memoir is based, Blood on the Border, a memoir of the Contra War, I found that I didn't have the words. I did publish one regular scholarly history that was translated also into Spanish and published in Mexico and published in England by Minority Rights Group. But there was so much more I wanted to tell, and I think the essence of it was that I wanted to tell, express, not just tell, the consequences of military intervention, U.S. military intervention, of imperialism, the horror of the that is foisted upon ordinary people. And because I myself became a kind of target and a victim of the U.S. intervention in Nicaragua, literally on various lists for assassination. They killed, the Contras killed several foreigners who were working with the Sandinistas, including one North American citizen, Ben Lindner. And I think I came close to that, but it was just paled in comparison with the effects of on the lives of Nicaraguan citizens, mostly poor, with 50,000 deaths out of 3 million people. That would be like 2.5 million people, civilians, killed in the United States. So it literally affected every family, loved ones, separation. In the case of the Mosquito Indians, half of the population, because they lived on the border, and it's very densely populated, that border with Honduras. They were in refugee camps in Honduras that were more or less controlled by the Contras and really administered by John Negro Ponte, who was the U.S. ambassador to Honduras and is now the National Intelligence Director for the United States, oversees all spying, covert operations, eavesdropping, everything. And he's, in my mind, a war criminal. So I said, you know, I really had to write in a different way, and I started trying to write it as a novel. And I don't really want to do this because it's the truth, and I want to people to know it's true, because with fiction, it can often be based on facts, but you don't know for sure if it's true because you're not saying it's fiction. So I realized I had to learn to write creative nonfiction, and I couldn't do it. I didn't know how, because I had written for so long as a scholarly historian, where, for instance, you never bring yourself into the picture. The I voice is never there. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be one person observing and making that clear that it's me and not just the so-called objective observer. And so I started, I realized that my favorite form of writing that I read myself really is the memoir, from St. Augustine to Simone de Beauvoir to Tobias Wolff. These are books that are treasures for me as works of art. So this is how I want to write it. So it took a while of, and then when I started, what really happens is, unlike scholarly work, you start tapping in to the emotional level of your own being. And that's what then makes it art. And once I started tapping into that, all kinds of other things came out, including my own childhood and the similarities between growing up poor and rural and Southern Baptist in Oklahoma with the people I was with in Nicaragua, the Mosquito Indians, who had been missionized by Protestant missionaries from the United States, including Southern Baptist, but mainly Moravian, who were very poor, without electricity, without any kind of, modern conveniences. And that's how I grew up. And my mother was part Indian, too, so the sort of mixed identity of the Mosquitos, that I found myself more and more just getting diverted and writing what I called my red dirt stories. So I finally gave into that and wrote the book, Red Dirt Growing Up Okie. And then I looked at that and I said, really, before I write about the 1980s, I really wanted to write about my political politicization. Because coming from that background, it's not exactly the most ordinary background for most people who became involved in women's liberation and the anti-war movement and anti-imperialist movement in the 1960s, which I did. So I wrote Outlaw Woman, a memoir of the war years, 1960 to 1975. Well, by this time, by the time I turned that manuscript in, it was published in 2002, and I turned it in really at the end of 2000. I started working on it, but people kept telling me, I mean, good friends that I really trust, including publishers, that I shouldn't focus on the Contra War in Nicaragua because no one was interested anymore. No one would read it. So I kind of bought into that, and I was, because it was going to cover a 25-year period of time, So, well, yeah, I'll make it a chapter in the book. It was 9 years out of 25 years. That makes sense. Then George Bush was elected. And the first thing he did after inauguration was appoint the same John Negroponte to be ambassador to the United Nations. And I said to myself, I just threw that manuscript away I was working on. I said, this book is going to be about the Contra War. And he appointed 18 others who had been involved in the Contra War. And I think that's why we're seeing now what we're seeing, the use of torture, which was really wasn't the first time it was used by any means, but it was highly developed as a technique of terror in the Contra War and also the military in El Salvador and Guatemala. And John Negroponte had a lot to do with it. It's not meant to get information out of people. It's meant to terrify other people who see the tortured body. They would put the tortured body, say a man with his eyes gouged out, his ears cut off, his penis cut off and stuffed in his mouth, would be by the roadside when people would walk by going to work the next day. So this was, you know, a message. This is what will happen to you or your son or your husband or your daughter if they are sympathetic to the Sandinistas or to the guerrillas in El Salvador or to the guerrillas in Guatemala. So the whole argument about whether or not it's effective, I think it's insidious. It's okay to do those things if it's effective. And of course you don't get good intelligence from that, but that's not the point. It's against the law, against U.S. law, signed the torture treaty. So how to put this, all of this kind of material into a memoir and make it work also as art, I think was a real challenge. I think it succeeds, but it's not an easy task. And I hope to see a lot more people who've had these kinds of experiences and knowledge trying to communicate it in a way that really does get to people's emotions and their conscience rather than simply the intellect.
You call yourself an engaged intellect on your website. I'm listening to you, hearing how the politics on a large scale affects your own personal life. I'm wondering how much you've learned, what kind of insight you've taken as you tread those two paths.
Well, you know, it's, I think only in the United States that it's controversial to call yourself an engaged intellectual or an activist historian or even an activist novelist or poet. There's some, you know, there's a sort of immediately in the mainstream, there's a lack of credibility. And it's hard, I think, for people who want to reach wider audiences to overcome that and say, it doesn't matter, I'm going to do it anyway. Or they say, well, they'll wait until they become really well known and then they'll take a stand and it will be more powerful. And many academics do that. Well, when I get tenure, then I'll be an activist. But after time goes by, and maybe 10, 15 years before you get tenure, you really become so much a part of the system that you no longer see it as something you are committed to do. You know, it has an effect on you. So definitely those of us who do it are limited in our ability to publish in the mainstream, or artists, visual artists who do this, or filmmakers are, I mean, maybe a few things slip through, like Michael Moore, but he still receives all kinds of attacks on his credibility. He's been able to get rich and continue his work, and certainly has an audience, or say Noam Chomsky. But I believe maybe there was one review, but for instance, Noam Chomsky, who's much older than me and is has written God knows how many books, 500, I don't know, and they're all good, and is very popular on the lecture tour, has never been reviewed in the New York Times Book Review, has never been reviewed in any mainstream press, or interviewed, asked in for interviews. Finally, Book TV did an in-depth thing with him and Howard Zinn, because many of us wrote in, you know, protesting, say, how come they're having all these really, really radical right-wing people on, and then having someone they call a leftist, who's usually a kind of milquetoast liberal, and, you know, that's not balance, if that's what they're looking for. I think the whole balance thing is very deceptive, because they put on extremists on the right wouldn't have been taken seriously 20 years ago, because they're nutcases, and then having no one on the left really expressing radical ideas. So it takes its toll, but I think there are ways. I mean, like Pacifica and the alternative media. South End Books published this book, and I really hand it to them. I think if people buy this book, the author never gets very much money from a book, but it is really a good cause. It's a nonprofit, and publishes books like Noam Chomsky and Arundhati Roy that wouldn't otherwise be available. So there are, and you know, if one can see that as not only supporting a growing movement, and, well, South End's been around a long time, but getting more attention now, that I don't think, you know, it takes being in the mainstream, and that's very tricky anyway. So I'm very much for the alternative media. I'm very happy to be there.
Does the idea of being a memoir writer, an artist, give you some strength?
Well, it does. You know, it's a strategy for me to write in that way, but now that I am accustomed to it and really working on the writing itself, it would be very hard to go back. In fact, I recently did it, write a scholarly article that takes all of the passion out of it, as, you know, highly footnoted and all. Of course, I'm in the position that I don't have to worry about getting tenure. You know, I understand those things. You have to publish certain kinds of things to get tenure. I've also been made the choice pretty early as an activist. I have a doctorate in history from UCLA, 1974. I decided to take a job and stay within the state university system in California. That's the, not the UC system. We have 23 branches. They're the working class universities that no elites go to. They don't offer PhDs. There are few MAs, no medical schools, no law schools, no prestige, no big government money coming in. And really devote myself to teaching working class students. And I went to such a college as an undergraduate, San Francisco State College. And I so appreciate the devotion of the professors I had there, who could probably have been somewhere else. I mean, they were extraordinary people. And I decided that's what I wanted to do. So that immediately limits you and your prestige, you know. It's not that Yale or Princeton or anyone was, you know, knocking themselves down to recruit me. But I could have presented myself in such a way, you know, I knew how to do it, that I could have gotten hired by elite universities. But I made that choice. It's not that I haven't regretted it sometimes, but I respect it, you know, that my younger self made that choice. And again, I hope it's a choice that many young scholars will make, and not just working class schools, but to work in the interior of the country with students from the so-called red states, you know, to make yourself available and much more vulnerable. I mean, none of us in the California state system are as vulnerable to right-wing attacks as the most liberal professors, say, at University of Oklahoma, or take the case of Anita Hill, who was in the law school at University of Oklahoma. She really had to leave. I mean, she had to have several bodyguards all the time. It was a miserable life to lead. Her whole family was in danger, anyone who associated with her. So she's at Brandeis now. So that's, I think we really need to support our faculties and teachers, you know, in the public schools and librarians in these places. They are very courageous.
I want to talk a little bit about people, artists as people, and the issue of identity. You have an identity that seems to have a place in destiny through the 70s, 80s, and where we are now. You were Native American, and you're female, and you're courageous enough to travel, obviously, to places like Nicaragua. What about the role of the people who are just, you know, artists who are walking the streets of Houston, and their identities don't cross the kinds of things yours did, even if you made those by choice, which I don't want to belittle?
Well, it's a really a hard society, not just Houston, but the whole United States, to be in as an artist, and I would say a true artist who is independent and doesn't go get a master's or a PhD to teach. My daughter is a wonderful artist, visual artist, and she has always had to work full-time in sales, in, you know, these kind of crummy jobs. She hasn't wanted to be in any position where she would say go to the top, and she's quite studiously avoided any skills that might get her such a job, like computer skills and so forth. But I really respect her a lot, you know, and I know how hard it's been for her, and she has been able to rely on me and her father for some support. But not all artists can even have, you know, that sort of safety net with family. And I can only say that I'm sure that they wake up in the morning and look at themselves and can have a sense of self-respect that's rare in this society, because most people are doing things that they don't respect themselves for, and they're forced to do, especially working class people. Again, I think we need to form and there is some of this, it's not starting from scratch, but I think we had more of it in the 1960s or, say, in the 1920s, where communities of people have a lot of mutual assistance and help take care of one another and nurture each other so that one is not so alone. I think the late 80s and 90s have been very lonely times for artists and activists, and maybe political activists have more of that kind of community than artists are by nature, you know, need to be alone in a room working, unless they're a filmmaker, and then they need to, you know, have a few people alone in a space working. So it's really hard, but I think any way we can, like here in Houston, I'm sure there's some sense of community in the art community. But then there's always this mainstream art community that gets all of the funding, gets all of the grants, gets all of the support from governments or nonprofits, and then the artists who's really trying to be true to herself is left kind of, you know, stranded. So all I can think of is we really need to build community where we can. And friendship and lots of mutual assistance, but mutual respect and tolerance. And we certainly need more of that among political activists, too.
Now, art gives us the liberty and the freedom to range into individuality. And you have chosen a certain kind of individuality, and you seem to... I want to essentialize it. It's hard to take any kind of art seriously when you're talking to somebody who lived in Nicaragua as you did and will experience that, and I'm sure a multitude of other kinds of pressing issues. So, would you comment on individuality and art, artists and privilege?
Well, you know, I think a big mistake we made in the 1960s, and I made it too, and I also felt a victim of it. I mean, it was a kind of groupthink that we demeaned art. Sure, use the artist to make a poster for a political purpose. And plenty of artists made wonderful posters, or musicians that gave themselves over to the movement. People like Barbara Dane, who didn't go the direction of Bob Dylan, say, but it doesn't make me appreciate Bob Dylan less either as an artist, because I think in our movements we didn't respect the time and space needed by the artists, and those who were more politically inclined, which I realize now I wasn't. You know, I got migraine headaches from meetings. I just soldiered through, you know, rather than saying, I want to be alone in a room writing. Writing as a historian, I could sneak time, because it's a more technical kind of writing, and it can be organized. I would kind of sneak time and often lie to people about what I was doing, because it just wasn't respected that you were writing a book, you know. And you get accused of, wanting to be recognized or adulated or make money. In the Native American movement, too, I remember the first book I published, The Great Sioux Nation, where I signed over all the royalties to the International Indian Treaty Council. And I didn't mind doing that at all. And there were, you know, really quite a lot of royalties. But to be accused of, you know, being an opportunist and wanting to write books, that really hurt, you know, when you were actually sacrificing afterwards. But that's all too common in the movement. And what's expected of artists then is they basically give up what they have to do to be an artist to simply produce, you know, for a political objective. And I think that's really wrong. And one of the reasons why we don't have the kind of richness, say, that exists in Latin America or Europe, where artists and activists respect one another's needs and don't demand that one is... that the politicals don't demean, you know, the artists for having to do what they have to do to be artists. You know, I think everyone needs to live the fullest of what they're meant to be, you know, where their passion is. And that in itself is political, in my view.
And where... I'm not asking you to speak as an historian. Where does the force of material interest play into this?
Well, a lot in the United States, because it's such a competitive dog-eat-dog society where you actually have to have money to live. You know, it's not like in France or Netherlands where the government supports artists even still now, or Canada, the supporting films, filmmaking. There's nothing like that in the United States, so people have to grub for money to live.
Now, how about other sources, such as the idea of an artist, which in this country may not involve politics at all? What about those forces?
The idea of what an artist should be? Or
yeah, like an artist should be Andy Warhol.
Right. Well, yes.
Which he was political, but, you know, he's also wealthy.
Yes, and, you know, a few do kind of are allowed, especially in times like the 60s, to cross over, Tom Wolfe, for instance, or Andy Warhol. But they become kind of useless then to other artists, you know, as a model, you know, of what you could do or be. And I think it, you know, one of the roles that an artist, and I would include, you know, artists, visual artists and poets, especially in this, that in this society, you really have to choose if you are going to seek monetary success. It's not the right way to do it. This is true of historians too, or anyone who teaches, you know, like in a university. You might be able to make a livable salary. It's not too livable if you have a large family, but for an individual it is, and it gives you time to do other things, but you're not going to get rich. So it's, you know, you really have to choose between, if you have a monetary goal. I think it ruins artists, you know, to simply seek a material goal. And I don't know about Andy Warhol. I kind of feel like maybe he was tweaking the times, and he really did have a material goal of, you know, being very wealthy and influential. It's hard for me to imagine anyone getting to that level without having that ambition, honestly. In the United States, it's not like things just fall from the air. A lot of compromises are made.
That is the idea that I was looking for, the material influences being, in the sense of historical materialism, there are forces that play upon us, right. And, you know, can an artist's, you know, what does an artist face as he or she is walking through this culture?
Well, I know I never trust myself. Like I said, you know, going into an elite university, had I done that, I know I wouldn't be the same person now, because I know people who went that way, and they're not terrible people. But it's I couldn't be as free as I am to do what I do and put up with the consequences. I'm well aware of the consequences. I also actually would fear making money. I mean, I would hope if it fell upon me, if I won the lottery or something, I would put it to good use. But the things you have to do, well, I don't even buy the lottery tickets, but have to do to get rich in this society, I think it does just nullify. And then once you have it, you become so separated, unless, and I know two or three people who literally give away all of their money, but they're fairly rare. And even they have a strange relationship with people, because they don't know who they can trust, or if they have real friends, or if someone's trying to get money from them. So but on the other hand, I don't. That's inherited money, and I guess you can't help inherited money. I've never had, and you know, 99% of us don't really have to worry about that or winning the lottery. So I think otherwise we're not going to become rich.
Well, is it a neurosis as we are trying to bring together, you know, something that we believe in from our heart with an audience, and
right.
Our fame, our popularity, our influence, our wealth, you know, call them the same thing in this case, must be something that we're looking at, or, you know, you wouldn't have purpose. We need someone to listen to you.
Well, that's it, you know, that the filmmaker, the visual artist, the writer, that you hope they find your art finds an audience. I think if we can appreciate more of developing art communities where, and movement communities, where people are then, you know, on the outside, like the, how the beatniks began, or punk, or, you know, so many things, that then there's an attraction to it that spreads. And, you know, maybe it gets devalued in the process, but I can't think that, you know, both the beats, you know, really led to the 60s, the hipsters to the hippies, and to the movement. It certainly had a huge effect on me coming of age in the 1950s in Oklahoma. I mean, very little of it seeped in, but that Time magazine paid attention to the beats and reprinted Ginsberg's poem, that got to me in Oklahoma. I saw it. But if we are strong enough, that was not because of Ginsberg or Ferlinghetti or anyone. It was because of a community that happened. And most of them have stayed very true to that. So I think we can have much more effect as a community if we really want to see social change of putting something forward. And then no one really gets rich. I think Ginsberg, he was never really rich when he died. Certainly Ferlinghetti isn't, you know, running a bookstore at a loss for all these years. Living in a small apartment, but it's such a rewarding life, you know, and you are having influence. And I feel, you know, being a part of South End Books, putting this out, being able to talk to people, it is helping form community, you know. And I think if we look at that more than our individual, I mean, we literally have to do the work as individuals, but if we see our reward as being more than just to us, but to the whole community, I think it changes the perspective, and you feel more on the ground and in touch with things, and you are influencing the larger society.
And then just have patience in the meantime.
Yes, have lots of patience, and be aware you're never going to get rich. And you're better off for it.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you very much for chatting with us
this
morning.
Thank you, Michael.
All right.
You have been listening to Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, interviewed by Michael Woodson for his KPFT program, Living Art. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz is a feminist, a revolutionary, and historian. She speaks about the art of memoir, the social contradictions inherent in contemporary art making, and introduces her latest book, Blood on the Border, a memoir of the Contra War. The interview was recorded in Houston, Texas, on February 10th of 2006. This program was produced by the L.A. Sound Posse. The L.A. Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-Alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. We share them via the Internet, community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots, social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.